to a close then, and I invite Chris Curtis from Youthscape to speak to us. An exciting story to tell, Chris. Chris is going to share with us. Chris is going to speak from up where Anita spoke, so you might want to just turn your chairs in that direction. Thank you, Chris, for being with us. We appreciate your time in your busy schedule. We look forward to what you've got to share with us. Thank you.
Good evening, Bedfordshire churches together. May I say how together you are looking this evening? Can you hear me if I bellow with my kind of youth worker voice? I hope you can. I'm getting old. I had a birthday this week, and I'm getting old. I've now been a youth worker. Not that I realise I look much like a youth worker, but I've been a youth worker for 31 years. To show you how old I'm getting, I said to a 14-year-old last week, I thought it was a good idea. I said, we should organise a disco. This teenager looked at me and said, what's a disco? And they absolutely had never heard that word before. And that was the moment that I realised things were sliding downhill. I don't know why I'm thinking of discos, because when I was a teenager, I would have had a disco in a hall not unlike this, and I would have been against that wall there the entire evening, very, very shy and unable to speak. But I've been a youth worker for a long time, and as I reflect back, and as I think about why I do what I do, I realise, and I wonder whether you are one of these as well, I really engaged with the Christian faith as a teenager. I mean, a little bit as a child, but really, for me, it was as a teenager, and in my case, well, it was both church and school. My school and a chaplain was where I really engaged with my faith. I don't know this is what your story was. Our chaplain was an amazing guy, actually. As an 11-year-old, it was a very strict school in Suffolk. And as an 11-year-old, I made probably one of the greatest mistakes of my life. See, this amazing chaplain was actually bald with huge jug ears. I mean, they were enormous. It's the first thing you notice. And so, as you remember, at school, everyone has a nickname, all the teachers have a nickname. And so this guy's, he actually was called Reverend Burrows, but his nickname was Wingnut, because that's what he looked like in profile. As an 11-year-old, in year 7 or year 1, as it was in those days, I sadly assumed that his name was Mr. Wingnut. That is not a mistake you made twice. And I did not, that was not received with great humour by Mr. Winger or anybody else. I mean, what's kept me as a youth worker all of these years is that those moments when you realise a young person is sharing something of themselves with you in the most profound way. It's an extraordinary and amazing experience when you realise you're included, you're safe, and they're willing to share something with you. And I think you may have experienced that yourself if you've worked with young people, but those moments are what drive me and what confuse me. And I was thinking of one just today, a lad I met in a Luton school. Now, I'm sometimes called in to Luton schools. In this case, this lad, I'm going to call him Otis, who's 14 years old. And he was a troublemaker. In fact, he was a fighter. And he was always arguing, but more than that, he was in fights, he was in scuffs. And angry at teachers, angry at the maths teacher, and you can blame anybody for being angry at the teacher. And it all came to a head when there was a skip, because there had been some building works in the school. It's a school in Luton. And he picked up a bit of wood from the skip and threatened another child with this wood. And lots of things happened as a result of that, but one of them is that I was asked to go in and meet Otis. And you go in and you're sort of, even now, you're nervous because you can't, what have I got to offer here? You feel insecure, I feel easier. Look at me, I'm sort of a walking advert for Marks and Spencer. What have I got that Otis needs? And you sit and you talk, and often in a school, because it's in a school, you often end up in reality. There's no good place to meet, so you're sort of stuck in the head of Year 9's room or so. There's a box somewhere in the school, and Otis is brought out of lessons to meet you. And we used to sit and chat, and it's okay. We talked about different things, and I didn't really know what was going on. But then I remember a couple of months in, I took him actually out on a trip, just the two of us. And we came back in the car that evening, and I don't know why, we were talking on the way back about what frightens you. And I must have been making some joke about, you're frightened of the dark or spiders, what are you frightened of? That? I don't know how we got onto that subject, but we did. And suddenly Otis says to me, what frightens you? And there was a pause, and he said, sometimes my dad gets really drunk and angry, and I lock myself in the bathroom, and he bangs on the door, and I'm really scared. That's when I'm really scared. And you're sitting there, you're driving, and you just, so a lot goes on in that moment. And you're thinking, gosh, what am I going to say? But actually, you're also thinking, this is an amazing moment, because this young man has, for some reason, found a safe space. And he may never have said that to anybody. But in that moment, he's entrusted me with that bit of his life and his world. And that's just an extraordinary thing, a truly extraordinary thing. And it's extraordinary to see, as you work with young people, them change. And what I love particularly, I love seeing young people change who everybody else says they can't. I've met quite a few parents in my time will say, well, you have a go with him, you haven't met him. I can't do anything more with him. You have a go, I'm done with him. Or you need to teach at some point. Sometimes they'll say the same thing. I don't want him in my class anymore. And you see, actually, so often these young people change, and everyone else has written them off. There's an amazing story of one of the great Jewish rabbis. He's a rabbi called Rabbi Akiva from the first century. And his story, actually, I think is really inspiring. He was he became a rabbi, but he, in fact, he became one of the Jewish faith's most revered, even today, most revered teachers and rabbis. But he came from a completely uneducated background. He was a shepherd. He was illiterate. He could not read or write. And he was destitute. His family was destitute. But he married a woman who was educated and actually saw in him something that even no one else could see it, but nor could he himself. And there's a story that goes where the real change took place. They were walking one day out in the countryside, and they came across a spring, and water was bubbling down onto a rock. And where it had done that, the rock had been hollowed out. It was a sort of bowl where the stone had been hollowed out. And his wife, whose name I'm afraid escapes me at this point, but his wife looks at this rock and says, look at this! Here, because right by this point. His view was, I'm nothing, I can't change. And she says, look at this. This is stone. And look, this water. This water has hollowed something out of this rock. And if this water can do this to stone, then you can change. And that apparently was the moment someone took that moment and believed in him. That was the moment he decided to change. And he began to train, and he became literate, and he eventually became a rabbi, and he actually ended up with 24,000 disciples who had committed themselves to following him. And there's a story some years later where he's walking, this is about 60-something AD, he's walking one evening along Galilee towards Capernaum, and he's studying scripture, and he's studying so hard, he forgets to take a turn back to his home. And so he keeps going through it, his sun gets set, and he comes upon a Roman outpost. And you know, this is the time, remember, when the Romans, you know, they're brutal oppressors of first century Israel. You know, this is not a party, but there's real oppression and all kinds of things going on. And as he nears this Roman outpost, the guard, there's a young guard on duty, and the guard sees this man coming towards him. And he shouts out, he says, "Who are you? Where are you going?" And Rabbi Akiva, as he is then, stops. And he pauses, and this guard shouts again, he's like, "Who are you? Where are you going?" And there's another pause. And then Rabbi Akiva shouts back, "How much have you paid every week to ask those questions?" And the guard, I presume, is a bit taken aback by this point. But apparently he says, "2 drachma." And Rabbi Akiva says, "I'll pay you double if you'll come and stand outside my house and every morning ask me those 2 questions. Who are you? Where are you going?" And I love that moment. I just think that's fantastic. Because actually, those are the 2 questions, aren't they? For human existence, that's what it boils down to. Who are you? Where are you going? Those are the questions. And the challenge as I work with young people is, where is it that those questions can be asked and explored? Where does that happen? Does it happen in school? Well, you know, I love schools, but I'm not sure. My son is at secondary school at the moment. He knows a little bit about geography and English literature and Inspector Calls and a few other things. I'm not sure how much anyone has asked him, "Who are you? Where are you going?" Is that what happens at home? Well, I wish it did. Perhaps it does a bit. If, in truth, I don't know about your home, I've got one teenager and one 10-year-old. I'd love us to have those profound questions. Normally it's why haven't you gone to bed? Why is that stuff left in the bathroom? I wish we would get where. So, for me, as I was growing up, actually the place where I first really, in some way, encountered those questions was in church youth group. That's the first time, I mean, I presume as a child, maybe that's part of what's going on, but really the first time I actually engaged with that in any way was as a teenager. Who are you? Where are you going? And in my time, of course, given how old I am, it was youth fellowship. So after the Sunday service, we went on Sunday morning to church. We went on Sunday evening to church. Do you remember these times?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem so long ago, maybe. And then after the Sunday service, evening service had finished, there was some young couple who had been gullible enough to be conned by the minister into being running the youth group. They nodded at the wrong point. And we would pile around their house. Do you eat. And you know, it was chaotic, and but in the midst of that, we were exploring big questions. And even as young people who were interested in lots of other things, those moments ran deep with us. And there were very few, even when I was growing up, there were very few other spaces where someone would go deep with me as a teenager about those things. And of course, the challenge for 2017 is young people are not at youth fellowship. Young people are leaving the church. Yeah. Do you know, across the whole of this country, 75% of all churches across all denominations no longer do any youth work in the UK. Yeah. 3/4. That's where we've got to. It's really challenging. And so the challenge for us, and the challenge for you, and this is why, by the way, we must do this together, because this is big. The challenge is, how do we find again young people? And how do we find a way, and a language, and a context in this age to ask and to talk, who are you? Where are you going? What's that space? Because it's no longer in youth fellowship for many young people or many churches. There's a story that I think captures this, and it's an apocryphal story. I don't entirely know whether it's true, but you'll indulge me, I hope. And it's about an Aboriginal tribe in the outback. And this tribe are in a valley. And the reason there's a village there, and the tribe live around the village, is a river runs through the valley. And this, of course, brings a life to the village. This is where you're washed, this is where you have water to drink. The river brings life, so the village thrives. And sometimes the waters are high, sometimes they're low, according to the season. But gradually, over a period of years, the waters begin to recede. Until eventually, they dry up. And there's a crisis. The riverbed is empty, it's desolate. And the village are called. And they call together, and they sit down, and the question is, what are we going to do? The river's dried up. And an argument breaks out. And there are some people there, and they say, well, look, the river's always been here. You know, my father knew the river, my father before that knew the river, his father. Yeah, all we need to do is wait here, the river will return. And there are others who say, no, we've got to move. We can't stay here. The river's gone. And eventually, in all of this, there's a split, and some of the villagers stay, but some begin to leave, and they gather themselves, and they head up through the valley, up the mountains, and as they get to the top, that's the first time that they actually see what's happened. Because as they look down into the next valley, they can see how the river snakes toward them, and they realize the river hasn't dried up, it's just changed its course, and now it's running around the mountain in a different route. And they realize the river is there, it's just in a different place. And that is the picture for me of young people in the church. You know, there are still young people in the world. They haven't disappeared. In fact, it's slightly possible. But there are 23,000 young people in Luke. They have not disappeared, but they move. And the church is sitting there and it's that same question. What are we going to do? And some say, well, let's just stay. It'll be all right. And others say, hang on, we've got to move. This is going to be difficult. We've got to move. And I suppose my work here in Luton at UCF is exactly that. We've been around now for 20-something years working with young people in the town. But I suppose the agenda, the vision that we've got right now is, how do we find the spaces and the language and the context to begin that conversation again? Where does that need to take place? And how does it need to take place? And what does it need to look like? If it doesn't look like youth fellowship at 8 o'clock around someone's house, maybe it still does for some, but if it doesn't, then what does it look like? And it's incredibly challenging. It's not a journey you should take alone as a church. This is why this gathering, this is why this is important. Because this is a problem and a challenge that we have to share together. Where do we need to travel to find young people? And we know that it's more complicated and more challenging. We know that the gospel, the good news, has to engage with young people in their world. And that doesn't just mean PS4s and Snapchat. It means mental health and sexting and all the other things that are part and parcel of young people's world. How does faith visit that world and engage young people with a conversation and ask them, who are you? Where are you going? Because actually, what keeps me hopeful, what excites me, is the Christian faith is good news to a 14-year-old in 2017. I think at times we sort of lose confidence. We look at these sort of, you know, slightly scary teenagers and we think, what have we got? I'll tell you what we've got. We've got everything. We've got Jesus Christ, the Redeemer, the hope of the world. I was just thinking this week, I have a sort of, I was going to say a love-hate relationship. I have a hate-hate relationship with the parable of the Good Samaritan. Because if you know, obviously, the parable of the Good Samaritan, Luke 7. I tell you what I don't like about the parable of the Good Samaritan. My daughter goes to a very secular primary school. And if they do a bit of Christianity, they'll do the Good Samaritan. Because it's sort of safe, isn't it? They feel like they're on safe ground. They don't do Revelation 20-22. They're right on the last days in judgment. They like the Good Samaritan because it's sort of being nice to people, even if they're not quite the kind of people you hang out with. It feels quite safe and everyone is like, oh, good old Christians, you know, good news. And I sort of look at that and I think, well, you know, I like that, but Jesus the revolutionary, Jesus the one who brings new life, that feels a bit like a sort of, you know, draining down to a very bottom common level. It was only a few months ago that I learned that for the first 200-300 years of the church, the parable of the Good Samaritan was seen very, very differently. In fact, Augustine writes about it. And their interpretation was much more metaphorical. They saw a story of redemption in the power of the gospel. And it goes like this. Augustine says, who is the man who's been beaten up on the side of the road? And if you remember, the context is a teacher of the law is asking Jesus, you know, what must I do? And they're having a conversation, and this parable sort of comes out of it. And the view that Augustine throws out is this: the broken man, the man who is broken and wounded and dying on the side of the road, that's the man asking the question. That's the church. That's you. That's me. That's young people, that's Otis, because we are broken and we're left on the side of the road. We are not perfect. We are broken and wounded. He says, that's us. And we're sitting there and we cannot help ourselves. And various people come down the road and we see religion comes down the road and legalism comes down the road. And can they rescue us from our brokenness? Can they rescue Otis from his brokenness? No. They have nothing to offer. And then a Samaritan comes down the road. And Augustine says, who's the Samaritan? It's Jesus. I think we've got a properly committed ecumenical sort of heresy at this point. But indulge me. And you can reflect on it later. But he says, the Samaritan is Jesus. And he talks a little bit more about that because he says the Samaritan is, it says in the text, is moved in his bowels. And it's a phrase used only of God often in the biblical text. But he stops, if you remember this Samaritan, he swaps places with the man. Remember, he's on a donkey. And he gets off the donkey, he puts the man on, he swaps places. He brings healing to his wounds. And he takes him to a place of safety. And I've given you a very bad precy there. But in it, the early church said, this isn't just a sort of be nice to strange people. This is a story about where healing comes to brokenness. And it comes from an unexpected place. And of course, the first century Palestine didn't expect it to come from Jesus. But it comes from an unexpected place in Samaritan. And I take that and I hold that story because actually I think that's a message for us. Because if you talk to a teenager today, and many of whom are broken, many stories I can tell you this evening. And you say, where's hope going to come from? You know, is it going to come from doing well at your GCSEs or owning your own home or heavens above becoming an accountant or any other terrible thing that might happen to you? It's a bit of bias coming through there. You know, all those men may not be good things, but none of that. Where is hope coming from? Where is healing coming from? And could it be the most ridiculous thing in the world would be that little old church on the corner you don't even look twice at on your way to school? Could it be that in that building, with that group of people who seem so ancient, excuse me, so ancient and old to you as a teenager, you think they might be a dead store and stuff? But could it be that those creaky old Christians in that little old church, could that be where hope comes from? Yeah. And of course, that's the mystery and glory of the gospel. That actually, the most unexpected of places, the Samaritan, is the one who brings hope. And actually, this world does not expect hope to come from the church. And I can tell you, young people definitely are not expecting you to turn up with the answer. But actually, that is the paradox and the glory of the gospel. Because we are part of God's move to bring hope to you. And we have something to say to young people. And my challenge to you, as I close, you'll be relieved to know, my challenge is actually, now is the time to leave the village as it was and think about where young people are and how you must begin a conversation with them and what that looks like. And that is a dangerous and difficult and disconcerting journey. But if we take it, and if those young people look up and see coming down the road is the equivalent of the Samaritan, the person they least expected to see, a croaky old Christian, but actually we hold this glorious gospel, which is redemption for a 14-year-old, and hope for a 15-year-old, and renewal for a 16-year-old. All of that, whatever the culture, it doesn't matter if you don't even know what Snapchat is. This is hope. If we hold that and bring that, actually we have something to do with it. And I really hope, that as churches we're going to think really hard about what our work with young people needs to look like in the coming decades. St. Catherine of Siena, one of my favourite saints, said this of many things, but most profoundly said simply this: if we are what we should really be, we will set the whole world.